Hey, 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 Kevin Guthrie here, talking all things mental health. We have a guest in the studio today. This guest today is Sarah Moakes. Welcome, Sarah.
Hello, thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here. So I'm going to begin with one of the many questions we have had from our viewers. And the question this week was, why do we need therapy? Well, you know, not everybody does need therapy, but it helps to process things. I have a lot of clients that hold on to words, hold on to emotions. They don't get the chance to speak, and I encourage them to speak, because if we don't express and if we don't say the things that we really, really want to hear, then they get stuck, and they get stuck in our system, and those emotions get stuck. So that's why it's important. And you know what? You don't need therapy. Sometimes you just need to talk to a friend. Bash it out with a friend. I talked on another podcast how, and this is a massive generalization, Sarah's going to either agree or disagree, that women talk more than men, so therefore they express more. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would actually. I think traditionally that's what happens.
Yeah, traditionally. We're trying to change it. So therefore, because women naturally speak more, there'll be less will get stuck, and that's of course why suicide rates are always much, much higher with men. Sarah, welcome to the studio. Tell us a little bit about what you do.
So I work as a clinical practitioner at a charity called the Children's Bereavement Centre, and we work with children ages from 3 to 18 who've experienced any kind of loss through bereavement. The majority of what we do is one-to-one therapy sessions with the children.
Wow. So, loss. Just give us a bit more background on loss. What do you class as loss?
Anything where there's been a significant relationship or there's been a connection with a person for that child, and then through some circumstances that relationship has completely disappeared overnight, suddenly, or a process of time through illness.
Okay. So it doesn't have to be loss in the sense of that they have died, not necessarily. I'm being whispered to here that it does. So it is about loss in the sense that person is no longer around.
Yes. Or we do pre-bereavement work, which is that there is someone in their family or a close person to them who will die due to illness, and everyone's aware of that medically.
Right, okay. So you're prepping then for what's about to happen.
Yeah.
Okay. What's the toughest part about your work, do you think?
I think there's an element that getting people to recognise that children grieve in the same way that adults grieve, or their need to grieve is the same as for adults. And getting people to recognise that sometimes children will need support in that process is important, because again, traditionally it was felt that children were quite able to adapt and would just move on from a bereavement.
Yeah.
Not in the same way that adults can. So I think it's getting people to recognise that the support's needed. And then obviously sometimes the journeys with the children are really difficult, but that's part of being in that job and wanting to be in that job.
Yeah. So there's more recognition around now that young people need this.
Mm. Yeah, I think traditionally, I mean, when I've spoken to people of all different generations who had a loss, kind of my grandma's generation, someone would just disappear and no one would talk about where they'd gone.
Yeah.
And then I think kind of mum's generation, it would be more of a kind of you just got to get through it thing, and nobody would seek support.
Yeah.
And I think now we're getting to the point.
Okay.
Hopefully people recognise they need support.
Good. Because loss is loss, isn't it?
Mm.
And I find even with adults that sometimes, I've worked with people where they may have lost somebody 10 years ago, and they think it's gone.
Mm.
But honestly, it hasn't. Because when they start talking about that person, they just break down instantly. There's tears, there's emotion. Then they go, you didn't grieve for that person, did you? And they went, I'm not sure. Why? And then they would look at me and say, why do you think I haven't? I said, because you're still crying.
Mm.
And although we never forget, we never, ever forget anybody, it's the emotion that we're trying to process.
Yes.
And it's about making it less. I remember working with a client who It was painful. It was, and then it was 10 years on. The loss was 10 years previous to the work we were doing. But the pain that was still sat in front of me was incredible. And she says, why is this still so painful? It's because you've not processed the emotion yet. And it took a long, long time in therapy even to get to the point where she was then able to bring the bereavement part of it. And then when she was ready and we did it. And I just happened to bump into her a few months ago and she was like, I feel way, way better. And I'm now able to think about that person, go and see the grave, and actually remember the good times that we had. And now it doesn't feel painful. And actually, that's what we really want, isn't it? It's, we don't want to feel the pain.
Yeah, or we want to kind of feel in some way that we're able to move past that or grow past that without it being the most significant thing that's happening day to day.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And for me, it's about being able to remember that person as well in a much brighter light. Why would we want to avoid thinking about a dearly lost person and feel that pain?
Yes,
but we're gonna try and avoid it, aren't we? So what sort of things do you do with young people to help them process grief?
I think obviously depending on the age, where the child is in terms of their grieving process, it's things like helping them to understand death.
Yeah.
Helping them to understand what's happened to their significant person, and helping them to understand a range of emotions that they're now experiencing that might feel muddled and strange and unusual.
Yeah.
And kind of working with those to say these are okay, and how do we learn to cope with those, and how do we continue to thrive and continue to grow around that grief, with that grief.
Yeah, because like I said earlier, they won't forget. They won't forget that happened. Grief's always an interesting one for me because it's part of life. It's sewn into our very, very being.
Yes.
And it's going to happen.
But it's very much avoided in terms of us talking about it, us being willing to sit with it and acknowledge it. It's really kind of missing in society, I think.
I can't remember whether I've asked you that this particular question, but why do you think that is? Why do you think we avoid?
I think for a lot of people, it's their greatest fear that either it's going to happen to them or it's going to happen to somebody else. And it's kind of knowing, I suppose, that what's going to come along with that is a lot of difficult feelings and a lot of pain. So although we know it's inevitable, we're not willing to kind of engage as much talking about it as we are other things.
Yeah. I wonder as well whether it, and this the word fear prompted this thought. I wonder if the very fact that we're all going to die, because we're all going to, we will all expire at some point and leave this earth that we walk. I wonder as well whether it's a reminder. I know sometimes when I work with older people and their peers around them start passing, as happens when people get into the latter years, the fear around death gets greater and greater. But I wonder if people think that by facing up to death, by grieving, that they are also looking at their own mortality in some weird way.
I mean, it's a tough thing to look at,
and
it will obviously evoke a lot of emotions around it, so it's by no means an easy thing to face head on. But hopefully the more it's kind of talked about and the more it's addressed, the more people out there will get support and will support each other in a more proactive way.
You ever heard of a death cafe?
I have, only recently, but yes.
Oh, did you see it on Facebook the other
day?
Yeah,
so it was really interesting.
What did you think of it? Let me describe to the listeners what the concept is. So a death cafe is... it's not a cafe full of dead people. It is a it's a group. It's like a kind of therapeutic type group that meets in a cafe maybe once a month. And what happens is you talk about death and you talk about your fears around death. And you, I'm not sure whether you would talk about bereavement as such, but you would certainly talk all things death. And the reason that people have started setting these up is because we want people to be more engaged in something that is going to happen to us all. And something that we are all going to experience on some level. And let's remember, that's not just the death of loved ones around us, but pets and animals, and also because the same amount of the times I've seen and felt myself massive grief through the loss of a dog is huge, absolutely huge. But a lot of people, I had somebody come to me recently, and she says, I feel ever so daft, but it's completely floored me, the loss of this dog. And I was like, why do you feel daft? That dog has been with you for 15 years, followed you everywhere, like a little shadow. Why would you feel daft over that? This is your time now to process this. And she did. But again, we might look at that and go, oh, you know, you get these people that go, it's only a dog.
Yeah. And I think as individuals, we kind of feel that we must just carry on through things and we must be able to move past things quickly. And I think kind of the media and things like that, television programmes, it always seems like there's something really significant, a death happens, and everyone just carries on the next day.
Yeah.
And I think that puts pressure on people to feel like they can't take that time to grieve.
Yeah. And I'm right in thinking that grief doesn't always come immediately either, does it?
No, I mean, we see children and adults that ranging from the bereavements happening in the last 6 months to the bereavements happened 10 years ago. And as you say, it's kind of whether it's processed at that time depends on how well you're going to cope with that, or whether there's a further bereavement that then resurfaces the original bereavement.
Yeah, absolutely. We talked a little bit about this earlier. So what can happen is if we don't process a grief. So a traditional pattern can be, somebody passes, you may go through a long period of illness where you look after them, then they pass. Mm-hmm. Then you have the funeral to organise and everything's happening, there's loads of people around. And it's not until everything settles that the grief starts creeping in, because up until that point, you're too busy, aren't you?
Yeah, and you've got a lot of people around you. People are coming to see you every day. People will ring you every day. And then it can almost feel like when that funeral's happened, or all the paperwork's done, all the official stuff, all that kind of starts to fade away.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the lonely place where you just sat with your grief.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And then what people do is when they start feeling it, is they then quite often get busy with other things. Mm. So let me throw myself into work, or let me go on holiday, or all sorts of things just to avoid it.
Mm. Yeah.
It's almost like you feel the dark shadow kind of creeping up on you and you just move faster to try and get rid of it, which a lot of people do. But the truth is, it has to be processed. Mm. And the other thing that happens with that is, I find, is that people will say, yeah, but I don't feel it as much anymore. And I'm like, but it's still there.
Yeah, yeah. It's just maybe masked by other things.
Yeah. I quite often talk about boxes and the fact that it'll be stuck in a box somewhere, deep down in the unconscious mind.
Just waiting.
Just waiting. And then what happens with the box? Mm. As we both know, something else happens and triggers the box. The box opens and lets out the first part of grief that wasn't processed.
And it might not necessarily be something that you would consider hugely significant, but at some point something will trigger that box to open.
Yeah. I just remember having a dog put down many, many years ago, and my reaction in the vets having the dog put down was really extreme. Mm. I remember just bawling my eyes out. And then I was thinking, whoa, what was going off there? That was, I mean, I loved the dog. And it was really, really sad to see the injection going in. But I remember thinking, what was happening? And I think it was partly it was an unprocessed grief from my parents that just in that moment, I just became overwhelmed by what was happening there. So what we're looking for is overreaction, is situations where we go, wow, that was a really big reaction.
Yeah, if something seems kind of disproportionate in terms of your reaction to it, it's possibly that it links to something deeper than what's on the surface.
Yeah. Do you enjoy your work?
I do very much so. I feel it's a genuine privilege to be with the children on that journey from arriving on day one, nervous, unsure what's going to happen, worried about how the sessions are going to be, to see their progress and hear their progress from people around them and from them themselves. Is just why I do the job.
Yeah. Would you like to continue?
Absolutely, yeah. I feel kind of this is what I was meant to do with my life in whatever capacity I'm meant to be kind of working in a therapeutic environment.
So where do you see your journey going?
Oh, what a question.
Big question, that one.
I think there's so much importance to support the charity organisations that kind of hold up the whole system in terms of providing support that's not available through local authorities.
Yeah.
So I've definitely got a passion for working with the third sector and providing that free support for families as well. But I also recognise there's many different layers to offering therapeutic support, and I'm interested to kind of explore those through further training and further exploration of myself, really, and seeing where I want to go with it.
Yeah. For you, when we look at young people, what do you think is missing? So we're going to look at young people, we're going to look at their educational settings, and I'm sorry again to target it at educational settings, but children do spend a lot of time there. What do you think's missing in terms of mental health?
I think there's no kind of lessons, there's no subject that reflects mental health in that way, that they learn other skills, and it's such a massive piece that's missing for them to be able to openly talk, to recognise the importance of mental health, and to learn skills to help each other and to help themselves build resilience, have coping strategies for times when things are difficult and they do feel affected.
Yeah. So if you're in charge, what would you do? I'm going to put you in charge of the country for 30 seconds. Oh, God. What are you going to do in education, young people?
I think make mental health a mandatory part of the curriculum.
Yeah.
Make it a subject, make it a topic, make it regular, and make it engaging.
Yeah, I agree. I agree, you've got my vote. I see campaigns like this all the time on Facebook, and I look at them and go, why is this even a campaign? Mm. It shouldn't be a campaign. It should be mandatory, or it should already be in place.
Yeah.
I understand that we have to learn education. We have to learn how to read and write and how to subdivide and algebra. I'm not convinced on algebra.
No.
You can argue with me on that one. And people will argue with me on that one. But I would rather see something in place around mental health. And I see so many people in pain. Mm. That can't be happy, or that just can't process what's happening in their heads.
Mm.
And we're not even given the absolute basic skills to do that.
But we're given physical education, that's always mandatory.
Yep.
And there's encouragement of physical health, there's learning about physical health, but the mental health side of that is lacking.
Yeah, completely. And let's face it, it costs the country billions and billions of pounds every year in terms of mental health treatments.
Mm.
And that shouldn't be happening. Forget the human pain that's involved in that. And there's massive human pain involved in that.
Mm.
But for me, it just shouldn't be happening. I do see changes.
Yes.
You kind of see that there's more school counsellors than ever before, and there feels like there's more education happening.
Mm.
I saw the other day a campaign on... So they're now going to make it mandatory that all schools get an education around sexuality and gender, and they're actually making it mandatory now for the first time in, I mean, that's, we've come a long way since, I want to say Section 28, where Thatcher kind of banned any talk of sexuality in school. She was like, we must not promote different sexualities.
Mm.
That was clever. it was clever, Iron Lady. But now they are going to make it mandatory now that happens in schools. Okay. So that's good.
Mm, absolutely.
I think mental health is coming through. I know that in Scotland always do some really powerful stuff. They have said that they want school counsellors in every school, which is good. I saw a campaign the other day, or read something on Facebook about school nurses and how they're going to be trained to deliver mental health. What is your thoughts on that?
I think obviously, as with anything, it depends on the training and then on what they'd be expected to do with that training.
Yeah.
So them maybe being able to recognise when people need further support, deeper support.
Yeah.
But also them being, I suppose, a place to provide a safe environment for a child to go and just say, this is how I'm feeling, or I'm struggling.
Yeah.
and having that available in some capacity, I think it's got to be a positive thing.
Yeah. I think what I picked up there was expectations. I agree with you on expectations. Mm. I think if we... So what do I think about this? I think if you're a school nurse, then I would question whether you then wanted to be a counsellor or not.
Yes.
And there will be a crossover, and some school nurses will want to do that and be very passionate about it. Yeah. But I would also imagine that some would go, that's not what I signed up for.
No.
I want to work with the physical and not the mental.
Yeah.
So I think it's expectations. But to use them as a referral point is brilliant.
Yeah.
Or to use them as that first tier.
Yeah.
And some young people will just want somewhere to be able to go and talk.
Yeah.
But then if the school nurse realises it's getting a little bit too deep, then to be able to refer on.
Yeah. Because as you say, we're recognising that therapy doesn't have to always be the solution.
No.
But it's putting those things in place to give opportunity for talking openly, for sharing with peers, and then recognising times when actually, yes, further support than that is needed.
Yeah, it's almost like a tiered structure.
Yeah,
the government sometimes I do wonder whether they get it completely right. I'd love to know who their advisors are.
No idea.
I'd love to know who's advising them. Okay, so we're putting the world to right today. We're gonna increase mental health in schools. School nurses. I'm laughing because the chair that I'm sat on has just moved. just dropped. so that was unfortunate. Luckily, I'm not on the floor. I can still speak. But yeah, we are putting the walls to right. Next question. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that could be done at home, do you think?
Yeah. I think kind of being available to children to talk about their feelings as well as kind of the practical things, in the way that if your child comes home, you might say, how's school been today?
Yeah.
But you're talking kind of on a practical level. How did the lessons go?
Yeah.
If the conversation can be more open about how they're feeling emotionally, if they're struggling with things. And I think also as a parent or a carer, being open with your own emotions is helpful, to kind of make that place somewhere where it's okay to share different feelings, and the good feelings as well as the bad feelings. Especially with bereavement, I think it's important that children can see other people grieving.
Yeah.
And that becomes a normal process.
So to model.
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
To model
and
it.
And to also give skills. So if you're recognising that you've got things that you use to help you, it's finding those things for your child as well.
Yeah.
And helping them discover them.
Yeah, absolutely. I think modelling is really powerful. So remember that when you model, we can model positive moves and positive processes, but also the flip side to that is we can model not so healthy things like anxiety, depression. If a child sees a primary carer check a door to see whether it's locked 20 times, then that child will assume that that's normal behaviour, and that's what that child has to do.
Yeah.
So we have to be careful with that. But definitely, okay. So let's say, controversially, that we have a parent that says, "Well, actually, I don't know how to express emotions because I was never taught how to express emotions, and I've come from an era where my primary carers didn't, their primary carers didn't. So how do I then?" What would you say to a parent that was, I don't know, just talking to you and said, what do I do with that?
I think maybe that would be the time when we explored what support they've got and whether they're in need of something else to help them open that door, to then help their child open that door.
Yeah.
But I think, obviously, that's a difficult thing, and that's something that does happen regularly, that people find their response to the grief has been to close down because that's what they've learned to do.
Yeah.
And then it's difficult to then want them to do the opposite of that with their child, to help their child through. But I think that, again, is a time when the support helps all the family as a whole rather than just the individual child. Because by sharing and by being open to the idea of sharing creates the kind of environment for change.
Yeah, that it's all okay. I wonder, you know, I get a... I was going to say I get a lot of. I get a fair few referrals from parents wanting me to see their children, 8, 9, 10 years old. And sometimes, I mean, it depends on the subject matter, but I sometimes sit on the fence with that and go, actually, what I would really like to do is see both of you together.
Yeah.
And the reason I kind of go down that route is because I don't want to be the child's teacher or a teacher of emotions, let's say. But what I'd like to do is sit with the parent and the child to work with them together.
Yeah.
To help the parent model to the child. Mm-hmm. And it's a slightly odd way of working. I know a lot of therapists would just say, no, we'll just see the child, give the child their own space. But the other reason it's important is because for me, if I'm doing some work with the child and the parent doesn't know what I'm doing, then the child could go back in the chair, the parent could unwittingly unpick what we've put in place.
Absolutely.
So to see them together for me is way, way more powerful.
Yeah. I mean, as a charity, we're definitely open to that. We offer family groups and family therapy, and we work with the family as a whole because we recognise that, yes, the individual might need support, but also the individual in their setting at home needs support. So it's about providing that for everybody that's involved.
Yeah.
And making them part of the process as well.
Yeah. We were talking there like family therapy, aren't we? But it can be really powerful, can't it, the results?
Absolutely, yeah. Even kind of now, I can still be amazed at the progress that a child can make.
Yeah.
That the difference that they can talk about and they can reflect on. And what they've been able to achieve through the therapy can still be a really kind of surprising and lovely experience.
Yeah. Yeah, and I know what you mean with that. I kind of get the same with people. I think for me, it never ceases to amaze me when I see people move from one position to another. And you almost don't see it. And then all of a sudden you see it right in front and you go, oh, wow.
Mm.
And there it is, right there.
It can almost sometimes feel like you're sat in front of a different person.
Yeah.
This change in the kind of presenting of that person is so significantly different from what you recall from the first time you met them.
Yeah.
That you can almost see a physical journey as well as an emotional journey.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And sometimes it's, for me, it's the, there's no obvious place, and all of a sudden the client says one thing. They say one thing and you go, wow, where did that come from?
Yeah.
Get you with your emotional intelligence and your learning.
Yeah,
and you're
absolutely,
like,
yeah.
It's incredible. It's incredible to see.
Or you just notice subtle things like all of a sudden they make a step towards caring for themselves more and looking after themselves more. And the significance of that is massive because it then leads to other things.
Yeah.
And it starts the process of them valuing themselves.
Yeah. And self-respect.
Mm.
And self-respect. And I will have said this before and I'll say it again. It's the foundations for a happy, healthy life is to respect yourself.
Yeah.
Have good self-worth and good self-respect. I said on another podcast, I did a spiral curriculum for a school once. And in it, I threaded through respect through every year, and they were like, why have you done that? And I was like, because for me it's the foundations of life.
Fundamental.
If we don't respect ourselves, we don't then know how to respect others. Mm-hmm. But it gets so many different things.
Yeah.
So it's massively important. So Children's Bereavement Charity, what's the official title?
Children's Bereavement Centre.
Centre, okay. So if you hear of them, or if you see them collecting, or if you see any of their events, because you've got masses of events coming up this year, haven't you?
Quite a lot of them through Radio Newark, actually.
Yeah. Oh, Radio Newark are your one of the officials? No.
We are their charity
That's
of the
it?
Year.
Yes. Look at that for a link in. So if you do see any social activity or they're collecting, then please put your hand in your pocket because they are an amazing charity. And actually, you don't know when you're going to need them.
Absolutely.
So they do some great work. Sarah, I want to say thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
Is there anything else that you would like to give to the listeners before you depart?
I think take some time today to look after yourself, to do something that's kind of purely for you. Even if it's 5 minutes, just do that for yourself today.
Powerful, really powerful. And actually, I know that a lot of people listening to this, that will be completely alien. Mm. They won't even know what that means to give themselves 5 minutes of their own time.
It's a hard thing to get used to, but do it for 5 minutes today, do it for 10 minutes next week.
Yeah.
Just build it up gradually.
Yeah. If you're doing it for 8 hours, if you get to the point where you're doing it for 8 hours a day, you may have taken it too far.
Yes. You may have actually retired and not realised.
Sarah, it's been a pleasure having you in the studio today. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
So please keep on sending in your questions. We will endeavour to answer any that we can. And remember as well that we're looking for subjects. So anything that you really want us to talk about, then send them in and we will try and talk about them. All things mental health and well-being. I'm going to go now. I will speak to you soon. Echoing what Sarah said, please take care of yourself. Take care. Bye-bye.